Good afternoon, everybody. I hope everyone's made a really good new buddy called Death. We're all getting familiar. Just a quick reminder to turn off or mute your cell phones. And then another point that's really important. Canopus Center doesn't ask you to take out your wallet in order to come in the door and hear these teachings. But we do have expenses to bring her here, and we're not meeting our expenses. So just take a moment and think about, you know, how important and precious these teachings are, and they're helping us with what's going to be one of the most important moments in our life, and that's the moment when we pass from this life to the next. And think about what it might mean to you financially to go anywhere else to hear these teachings. And so if you feel in your heart that this has been precious to you or valuable to you, and you would like Canopus Center to be able to continue to invite teachers and make this happen and make nice offerings to the teachers also, then we would appreciate your support. We have donation box right outside the door on the wall, and there's one in the front lobby. And you can also go online, and if you just go to the website for the webpage for this event, then there's a link to where you can make a donation. Let's see. I think that's the main things I needed to tell you about. Yes, she should be back very soon. And just a reminder, if you weren't here this morning to hear about it, we do have a puja going on at 4:30, about half an hour after she finishes the teachings. It's a guru puja. It's a really lovely service. We usually do it both in Tibetan and in English. You'll see we've already set up some offerings for the puja. So you are welcome to stick around for that, and we'll share some of the offerings with everybody who's here. So thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you. So as a review, the 9-point death meditation without looking at your notes. So traditionally, what the teachers did is they would give you the teaching. At the end of the teaching, they would review what they taught. And at the beginning of the next teaching, they would review it again. So what you notice, and a lot of us notice about our learning, is by the third time, fortunately, sometimes we hope something sinks in. The first time's kind of a gush, so without looking at your notes, what do you remember about the 9-point death meditation? Okay, first of all, there's three roots, right? What are the three roots in order? Death is certain. Time of death is uncertain. Dharma is the only thing that helps you at the death time. Thank you. Okay? Under death is certain. Death is certain. Everybody dies, right? That's number one. Everybody dies. No power in the universe from stopping death from coming. Number two, reasoning. Under death is certain. That's the next section we're going to get to. Your meditation. What do you remember?
Everybody dies.
That was number one. Number two, from the meditation, you dropped out of the airplane. Closer and closer. Every moment. Every moment you're closer to death. Every moment you're closer to death. Every moment you're closer to death. Third reasoning under this heading. Death is certain. Third reasoning. What do you remember? There's no time to practice. There's not enough time to practice. Okay? So under death is certain, these are reasonings to convince us to practice. To practice now, and to practice well. So the first reasoning, the first root is death is certain. Everybody dies. Every moment we're closer to death, and there's very little time to practice Dharma, helps us generate a resolution, I must practice Dharma. Second main heading or root, we said is? Time of death is uncertain. What are the reasonings under this? Number one. People die at every age, okay? Number two. That's number three. A lot of ways we can die. A lot of things, more things supporting death than supporting your life. And the third heading? Third main heading. No, the main heading. Main heading. Only Dharma helps you at the death time. Number one. Under this. Possessions don't help you. Your money and possessions are of no help, right? Number two. Friends and family don't help. Number three. Body doesn't help. Excuse me. So the second point leads you to a resolution, meaning the second main heading, the time of death is uncertain, leads you to a resolution. I must practice Dharma now. Third resolution, well. I must practice now, and I must practice well. Okay? Let's look at the second two areas, because we did a meditation on the first one. Excuse me. So, the time of death is uncertain. It's difficult to realize, but you just scan all the different ages of people that die in your lives, that we hear about, we read about, that we know. You know? I don't know anybody that died at the exact same age as somebody else. Thank you so much. Thank you. Right? So everybody dies at different ages. We have no idea when you'll die. So you can do in a meditation, slowly, reflect on all the different ages. So how is it that I think I'll live to be old? Slowly, reflect on that. Then you come to the second point, is that there's many more things supporting your death than supporting life. I think we're pretty aware of this, okay? We don't reflect on it that much. Many more things supporting our death. There are natural catastrophes, accidents, plane crashes, environmental toxins, violence, war. Sometimes medicine kills you. Mismedication, overdoses, food can cause poisoning that kills you. Right now there's a flu going around that is nasty, and people have died of it within 2 days of getting it. Like, you don't think that when you wake up in the morning, you're fine, and then suddenly something happens. And the rest of your life is all different. That. So all these different things, and then this morning we were talking about spirits a little bit, and they say there's all these spirit hindrances, other things that we don't really identify as that, but it could be a sickness, something like that. So the third part that's related to this is the body is fragile. Body's fragile. So as a result, you may go into the hospital. This happened to my cousin. He went in to have benign polyps removed from his intestine, from his colon. Right, he had some heart issues, but he was fine when he went into the hospital, and he died on the operating table. Right, it happens to people. They go into the hospital with a more minor thing, and then you end up, something goes wrong, you get an infection, suddenly you're on a respirator, and you get the hospital pneumonia, and you're gone. Gone. Some little thing. The body's really pretty delicate, the balance, keeping that balance. People get food poisoning, and they die. An extreme case of that. I had a friend that had asthma, and it was always treated, and it was all that, and then he had an asthma attack. And they couldn't get him to the hospital fast enough. He couldn't breathe, and he died. This was one of the founders of Vajrapani Institute, who gave the initial property with his wife and some friends, like that. So it's not an earthquake that kills you. It's the building that falls down and crushes your body that kills you. It's not the earthquake. It's if you're outside during an earthquake, you're not going to die, generally. I mean, unless some building comes hurling through, you know, crashing down. But if you're just out in the trees just move. You're not going to die from that. Things like that. So those are all the kinds of things that, with the body being delicate, to generate, help you generate this feeling, I have to practice now because I don't know when everything will change. In a case like that. My friend I mentioned, who died of cancer, was given these practices by Rinpoche, and they were somewhat extreme practices. It was a lot of certain practices. So if you ever decide to consult with someone like Rinpoche, and a lot of people I know want to get their life practice, a life practice, it's fantastic because then you know what to do. Right? I find this so interesting. Then you know what to do. But people are afraid to ask him. because they're afraid. You know, people say, you know, you want to do prostrations, full-length prostrations, and he gives you 500,000 of them to do. Okay, but the thing is, it's your life practice. So he's seeing something that this practice can avert. It can help you avoid. Why don't you want to do it? Right? So my friend, who got an extreme amount of practice to do, never got started. Now with Rinpoche, sometimes you have great motivation and intent to start. I have another friend, he gave a lot of certain practices to do, and she was so enthusiastic. She's just like, I'm starting in 2 months, I've got it set up, I've got the retreat thing, I'm doing this. So enthusiastic starting, and within a month, she got a message from Rinpoche that the numbers had gone way down of how many she had to do. That's how it works, because there's so many factors, your motivation, practices. So my friend never got started, and there were many, many obstacles for her, excuses, why she can't start, and when, you know, different things. So then she got ovarian cancer. She died of it. And when she was dying, I used to go over and do practices with her, and one time in the middle of a practice, she was quite weak, and she was lying on a sofa, and I was sitting on the floor in front of her. And all of a sudden, she just turned her head really sharply, and she said, I should have started. You know, I should have done the Vajrasattva. I should have started. You know, but when you have cancer like that, it's too late, and you're too tired to do anything. So it's really helpful to get to some of these practices to do. And the other thing you can think about, not that everybody's ready, but the glory of this center is you not only have a great community and so many wonderful volunteers and people that help and benefactors, and I talk about your center. I travel a lot and I say, you know, Kadampa Center, you know, you're a great center, a great example. You have a great scholar, Geshe Gelug, amazing teacher, amazing being. Then you're guided by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. You have every perfect situation. So some people don't resonate with Rinpoche's style or whatever, but some people kind of, you know, he tends to come here once every year or two. That's pretty extraordinary. There's centers that wait 5 to 10 years to have Rinpoche come. So you guys have created some very positive situation, and you host Light of the Path, and Rinpoche comes here, and then he goes to the retreat in Asheville. It's great. It's a fantastic blessing. Some people make a connection with Rinpoche, with this being, and they may want to ask for a life practice. What do I do? And now it's computerized, meaning it's your specific practice that he has checked just for you. Just for you, whether you've met him much or not. But Rinpoche has that kind of mind. So, meaning it's computerized, meaning there's a standardization to the motivation and all these things that years ago we didn't have this. So you go in for an interview with Rinpoche. Maybe you had a little notepad with you. Some of us tried to tape it, record, and you'd be scribbling down this motivation. He'd be dictating very quickly, and you'd never get most of it. You'd miss, and then you try to share it with a friend. And so they standardized it because Rinpoche gives the same, very similar motivation. You've heard him teach, some of you, and he goes over and over the same stuff. Why does he go over the same stuff? We never heard it the first 80 times. Too distracted. Okay, so again, you hear it a different way. You hear it a different way. And excuse me. So you get this practice, and there's blank lines. You know, and then Rinpoche checks just for you. He has his method of divination, and I think just his mind alone knows. And then an attendant will write in what specific meditations. Maybe you have a meditational deity. You'd like to get closer to that practice. And different things to meditate on, and maybe some preliminary practices with how many of those to do. And then you know what to do. You know, and then if you're not sure what to do, you ask a senior student, can you explain this to me? And you just start from one by one. You just a little bit, and you get senior student can explain, you know, you could combine these and do this. And then you're off. You go for it. You don't have to worry anymore. People say to me, am I doing the right thing? What should I do? Right? So but people get scared because there's the truth here. You know, here's this pure being, and I think we get nervous in the face of that kind of clarity. We're not used to that. And people have this idea they won't be able to do the practices. But I think there's many holy beings that are trying to help us do it, trying to help us. Because it's about your freedom, right? It's about your freedom. So a question for you and something to look at in your spiritual life is, what is your relationship with freedom? I think we talked about that last year. What is your relationship with freedom? Do you feel free now? And what contributes to the freedom? And are you ultimately free? Are you free from suffering? Are you enabled and empowered to benefit all living beings? Things like that. Because if you could be really, really free, meaning free of all your suffering, free of any mental delusion, that would be pretty cool. So a lot of it is what's our relationship with freedom? How can I move along that path in a reasonable mode of time, reasonable for my life and what I'm doing? That's possible. I know really good lay practitioners too that have families and work full-time jobs, and so it's just priorities. You know, they have this practice that goes on. It's quite clear. They set things up. And that's just as important as the doctor's visits with their kids, their work, their investment fund. There's a balance. So there's a space for everything. So it's really your decision. It's your decision. What the problem is in the West is we have a kind of relative freedom, right? So when I'm in India and when I'm in some undeveloped countries, some of you have been, you see people carrying bricks on their head all day, working, carrying bricks on their head in the hot heat for like 30 cents a day. And you go, oh, I don't have to do that. I'm free. But then in the West, we have a lot of emotional angst, a lot of emotional burden and anxiety, right? So you might feel like I've got a car, and I can get in my car and I can drive here and I can go to the candy store and buy candy and I can, you know, watch this program when I want. And, you know, so is your mind free? And, you know, how free is your mind? And many people I know I talk with, and there's some really sad situations going on for them. You know, they're really not free, even though you can go in your refrigerator and say, oh, I think I'll have an orange or an apple or... So something to think about. So please think about that in your own passage, your bucket list. What's the level of freedom I'd like to get to? You could really be ultimately free and happy and peaceful. So when we also talk about nothing helps you at the death time other than Dharma practice. So this pushes people's buttons. Okay. Your wealth and possessions. Let's discuss this one. Wealth and possessions. Your wealth, if you have wealth, that may set you up with a lovely hospital bed in your home with round-the-clock care. The way you'd like it, you can control, nobody's sharing your room, nobody's blasting the TV, very good care. I've seen people that have afforded that and died miserable, the mind miserable. Totally tormented, freaked out, yelling at everybody. So money doesn't calm the mind, unfortunately. Right? The possessions, and I've seen people with possessions dying in a coma, in like a semi-coma, and suddenly there's two people standing over them, two sons or something, fighting about the deed to the house. And suddenly they kind of rally out of the coma. You know, like, you're not getting the house. You know, so possessions can really have you grasping at the death time. And it's very hard. We do not want to be grasping at the death time because it perpetuates much more of some kind of grasping mentality like that. And the mind at the death time is very important like that. So just something to think about, possessions, and you can't take any of them with you. I mean, it'd be kind of cool if there was a Dharma retirement account. You know, you could kind of say, okay, for my future rebirth, I need you to find that person, and this is the money for them. But it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. What's interesting for me is, and I want to talk about reincarnation after this, is we believe, Tibetan Buddhism teaches reincarnation. There's a belief in that, which indicates past lives and future lives. So I had, I've had a lama, some lamas give me certain things. And one of them gave me a ritual damaru, a drum. And another one gave me a statue, a Tara statue, and different things like that. And one of them has been reborn now. And I feel like in the future, I'll be giving him back this Tara statue to say, you know, when I'm too old or whenever, I might give it to him sooner and just say, you know, Rinpoche, this is actually your statue you gave to me. It's like I felt like I was tending it, minding it for a while, and I'll give it back to him. And I'd like to keep the connection, too, and it could be in a future life he's going to give it back to me at some point. You never know. Like, there's things like that you can imagine holding for a while for somebody. You can give it back. But a lot of those things keep you encumbered with it. And I've seen people at the end, you know, hanging on. But this happened with my great aunt. But her son's there. You know, she's still alive and was somewhat with it. And she had designated this piece of jewelry for me. This is before I was a nun. And it was in her will. And he shows me the sheet. I didn't really need to see the sheet. You know, I was like, with all the different things on there, who's getting what, and who's crossed out on it now. But she, you know, she was a very strong woman. And he, you know, brings in this stuff and says, I want you to give Amy the stuff now and tell her the story about it. And she just wasn't ready to do that. So it's, you know, and then it's in your mind, this little item that's what, really. So it's not something to think about. And when I, some years ago at Copan, an old Geshe died there, and I was so impressed because he left, they said in his room, all that was there, and I don't know if he had a room in the monastery in the south, I don't think he had much, and in his room all that was left was a second lower robe. This is called a shemtab, my lower robe, so one more, we're allowed to have two, so he had a second one on the shelf, and he had one ritual plate, that's all he had. And I saw that and I thought, that's how I want to go. Because think of some of you have been cleaning out parents' houses, dealing with your stuff. Some of you are paying money to store your stuff. Somebody will have to go through it at some point. Is that what you want to leave your kids? Is having to go through all that stuff? I'm doing it with my father's house now. It's time consuming for me. It's emotional. It's, you know, so just something to think about, start simplifying now, because your mind will be lighter, right? Because some of you, hang on one sec, some of you have, is it the basement or the attic, that closet, the drawer, the room?
All of the above.
All of the above, right? And you can't even get started. So and it's in the mind. It's like, oh, I got to deal with that. You know, what am I going to? Or I can't move because of the. I can't take that job because I got this. I can't do the thing because of the, I. All the stuff keeping you. Yeah. So let's break it down to simplify. Great way to get ready for death. Dealing with our stuff. A great way to get ready. Just slowly. It's one box at a time. One box at a time. One hanger at a time. You can do it. And meaning, be reasonable. You need to schedule it on your calendar. A lot of you have phones now with your calendars in them. Push the plus button. Make a new item. Seriously, you have to schedule it or it won't happen. And when you schedule 1 hour, start with an hour. 1 hour a week. And break it down. You're not going to do the whole room. It's overwhelming. So break it down. An hour a week. I'm going to go in. I got an hour. And the room, you open the door and you go, oh, and okay, what's right in front of me? Okay, these two boxes. So look at these. Nothing else. Block the two boxes, 1 hour. Set a timer if you want. 1 hour finishes, you're done. You may find right there, you have another hour. That's okay. Or keep it to an hour. So 2 boxes a week, that's 8 boxes a month. That's significant. It's possible. It's possible. You get excited. Suddenly you clean out the room and you have a meditation space. How exciting is that? Or even a corner. Even a corner. So it is possible. You just have to get off your butt and say, I'm doing this. I'm starting. Set a date. I'm starting Valentine's Day. That's my little Valentine's treat to myself. Is we're going to start that room. We're going to start that drawer. With it's possible. Right? Question?
I have a friend who is 80. My best friend, she's 80. And I probably do take her out, do things to drive her to dance because I want her to have this experience of before she leaves, right?
Right.
So it's like my, because I didn't have my parents here, so I just have that connection with her.
Right.
She's American. So I keep telling her she has storages everywhere. I've seen them. And I tell her, you need to clean that. I can help you or something. I said, no, but I'm so attached to it. After I die, people will do it. I'm like, no, you don't want to leave everything to them to do it. This is always our talk.
So she has a lot of storage units.
Yes.
Okay. And does she have children?
Yes.
Okay, so she's leaving that for them. It's a wonderful thing to leave your kids to clean out your storage units, right? I never get that with people. I'm like, kind of, right?
So but I do clean my stuff.
It's hard.
Like some weekends I'm just trying to empty stuff. From 8 to 10, I'm working, and she'll come and say, oh, Naga, you did such a good job. But then I said, you need to do it too.
Right, right. The problem is, if you wait till you're 80, seriously, so my dad, he was pretty good about cleaning stuff out until he got to be 80. Then he didn't want to do it anymore. So I got him over the course from, he's 90 now, he's nearly 91, for 10 years, he would do it with me. So I'd sit him in a chair in front of a closet, and I'm like, okay. He couldn't stand up long. Okay, you sit there. I'm going to hold up these old suits. You want this? You know, this is out of fashion. You know, but I got him involved. But I didn't really feel like doing that with him, but I did. We did. We did a fair amount together. Okay, but he just stopped. So it's like if you can get to it earlier, when you're 80, you're tired, you just, you know, you want to do other stuff. You'd like to do your practice, let's hope. So you don't want to be dealing then with, but you can clean stuff out pretty quickly. And think about the money. If you're storing stuff in storage, think about the money you could be donating to monks and nuns. Okay? But I'm just saying, or the center, or for people to do retreat from the center, for people to get to light of the path that can't afford it. You know, people benefacted. That's why I'm here. People help support that. So it's really important, those kind of things. So it's just something to think about. Something to think about. And I think it's better to think about it is to set a schedule with yourself when to do it. And put it in your calendar, like all the other things you put in your calendar, probably half of which are not that important. But they're in your calendar. Right? Susie's got that one, okay? I mean, just suggestion that you will feel lighter. So position and possessions, wealth and possessions, not that helpful. Okay, friends and family, how do they help you at the death time? Now, these people go, well, my family, my friends. Okay, we love these people. These are the people we like. So it's really helpful. We've done this for many people dying in the Dharma. I've done it many times. You might have a prayer circle. Could be Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, doesn't matter. Prayer circle, like-minded people come together. They may or may not have an idea of the person's practice. It would be really great in your death kit, your death papers, make sure a few people close to you know what your practice is and maybe know who to get to do that practice or can do it for you. I know people that had surgery. They were going to recover, no problem. But the 2 days after surgery, they really couldn't focus, so we would sit by the bed and read the practice to them. That's fine. They would have daily commitments, so we would read it for them, and they'd kind of, that would satisfy the daily commitment. It's a really, really helpful thing to do for people. And these kind of things have been going on for years with Christian churches and things like that. And they do say that people that are prayed for seem to do much better with recovery, surgery, you know, things like that. So we would sit around people's beds that were dying and do certain practices that Rinpoche recommended. And not only does it make us feel better, but the person seemed to be more peaceful. Many times I noted that. Okay. The other thing is you yourself can learn to be a resource from this book. So once again, I just want to mention, some of you weren't here last night. This book is available for sale. Thank you. And they have, again, this wonderful death and dying resource area of having a center with a library and a bookstore. It's fantastic. So there's a number of books. This is How to Enjoy Death. Can you imagine? How to Enjoy Death, okay? Preparing to Meet Life's Final Challenge Without Fear by Rinpoche. And all the practices are in here. You don't have to get familiar with all of them, but you have some idea. Let's say Medicine Buddha Puja alone. Fantastic. With the mantra. So an example is, I teach in Florida every year, and one time I was down there a few years ago, a woman was dying of cancer in her late 50s, from a Catholic background. Three grown daughters. And somehow they found she was Buddhist, the daughters knew nothing about Buddhism, but before she went into a kind of semi-coma, and then she was in a coma, she's like, get a Buddhist here. Get me somebody. Like you'd say, bring the priest. She's like, get me somebody. And they didn't know who to call, so they called Thupten Kongha Center, our center in the Boca Raton area. And I happened to just show up in town, and they said, like, there's this woman, and can you do anything? So the woman drove me down there. And I have my death kit. I have Kala Chakra sand and some holy water and mantras and things, and I know some. You can give me a booklet of something, Medicine Buddha. So we went, and the first thing, what's helpful for you is talk to the family outside of the room. Just get a sense of what would they like. Sometimes they want 10 minutes. They just want a quick 10-minute, and I might say some Medicine Buddha mantras quickly and use some holy water and put some holy water in her mouth or on her head or quick, you know, and sometimes they want everything. So I first took them out of the room, got a sense of the daughters. They were quite spacious. And I said, here's some suggestions. It's up to you. You know, and they wanted the works. They're like, we want the whole thing. We want the Medicine Buddha. And so we brought booklets, and I said, it's in English. And they said, can we do it too? Well, yeah, you can read in English. I describe visualization. Okay. So when you get to the mantra, there's a mantra section. You recite the mantra. So I leaned over her. She was in a coma for 2 days. I leaned over her and told her what to visualize. And I said, you know, we're doing this practice, and I want you to visualize these rays of light coming down. I'm going to recite this mantra. I spoke really loudly to her, leaning over the bed. And we started to recite the mantra, and she started reciting the mantra. So she must have heard the whole thing, but she wasn't able to. Already the earth element, we'll talk about in a moment, is dissolving, like as you're dying. So you're not able to move sometimes or speak or, you know, but she could hear the whole thing happening. She was very peaceful. And she died, I think, a day and a half later, and they said she was very peaceful. So the second thing that happened was hopefully good for her, seemed to work for her. When I left, the daughters were so happy. Because if it's your mother's dying wish, and you don't know what to do, but you got somebody there. So if you're a Buddhist, it's quite easy to learn what to do and develops, and it empowers you to develop some confidence in yourself that I can do this, I'm there, and people are dying all the time. And a lot of times I see centers or people and they go, we don't know what to do, you know, he wants somebody there, I don't know what to do. So you know what to do and you go and you can help the person. And it helps them and it helps the family. So as far as family and friends, that's enormously helpful to do. But this is the way other family and friends show up. Sometimes. They're crying over you. I've seen family and friends crying over people, begging them not to die. I can't live without you. I don't know what I'm going to do. Or negatively speaking to you. Can you imagine? So it happens. It happens. You know, I had my great aunt died and her two sons flew in from the East Coast. It was in California. They're grown men. They're a year apart. They were in their 60s. And she's pretty much in a coma in the room and they start arguing, talking loudly in the room. They never got along. So they're in the room and I noticed her breathing shift, get really agitated, really, you know. So then I just went over to them and I said, is it possible to just discuss in the hallway? And they immediately were like, oh, yeah. And they went out in the hallway and then she kind of calmed down and, you know. So again, those kind of conversations best to take out of the room. And so family and friends, sometimes it's challenging. And then the poignancy, some poignant deaths that I've been around are, so we're very attached to family and friends. If you're the dying person and your attachment can be really strong too. So you see the person, and so there are times, and some of you have been involved in this, I'm sure, you're in a hospital with somebody day after day after day dying of cancer or old age or something, an illness, and then you're really exhausted, and you're not living a normal life, and you're not eating much, and you're down in the hospital cafeteria, so you go down to get a cup of coffee, take a break, 10 minutes. You come back up, and they passed away. So don't beat yourself up. Because sometimes they're waiting for you to exit stage left, to pass away. They're too attached to you. So there was a guy in San Francisco General Hospital when I did the AIDS hospice work, and they had a special ward there that was for people that didn't have a lot of money with AIDS, and they were fantastic on that hospital. So a guy from Sweden, I've told this story before, was dying of AIDS. His mother flew over. She was great. And she was there every day for weeks, and he was really, should have died. He was really in bad shape. And then one day in the morning, he asked one of the nurses to take his mom out in the hallway and explain that he had to die. And could she go off in San Francisco for the day? I always get kind of choked up about this. And just have a great day for him to celebrate their relationship. That she's been a great mom, but he needed to pass away and he couldn't do it with her there. So the nurse, talked to the mom. The mom totally understood, totally got it. And she came back in the room and they had a goodbye. They said what they needed to say and, you know, very tearful. And she went out into the city for the day and he passed away, you know, like a few hours later. And so sometimes it's like that we're hanging on to each other. And it's okay to let go. It's okay to encourage somebody to let go sometimes. Sometimes they need to hear that it's okay. I'm going to be okay. You know, my cousin also, my cousin is my age. And when her mom was dying, we were very close, the whole family. When her mom was dying of cancer, her grandmother was alive, the mother's mother. And she was in a nursing home, the grandmother. So the mother, again, was lingering in a coma, and the nurses took my cousin aside and finally said, you know, is there anything else that's not, she wants to talk to somebody? And my cousin finally, she said, it's my grandmother. She's worried about my grandmother. So she went in the room. Her mother had been in a coma, unresponsive. She went in the room and just talked to her mother. She just said, Mom, I've got it. Grandmom's going to be fine. I'm on top of it. I'm going to take care of her. You don't have to worry about anything else. And her mother just put her hand up like this, and then she died, just passed away. So sometimes there's ways to, it's hard to let go, right? It's hard for us to let go. But we just slowly, you know, find the presence of space, because everybody dies. Everybody dies. Much better to be the friend and family that shows up to allow it to be a peaceful way, what they want to do. And sometimes you say the wrong thing and you make mistakes. And hopefully, sometimes you find spaces to laugh with the person. You know, or you see somebody that comes in the room that doesn't know what to say. And then they leave and you and the person or you and the dying person are like, okay, well, that was interesting, wasn't it? You know, because it's uncomfortable for people. So again, slowly, slowly, how friends and family, how you can show up. And we'll talk more about that as well. Kim?
Sorry.
Question?
My question
Yeah, my concern is that not knowing when, you know, I'm going to die, so could be next week. My concern is that my daughter, if it's next week, may not have the maturity yet to be able to let me go in a way that is a positive way. And my concern is that if I have a Buddhist friend there, hopefully, that, you know, that they will try to say to her, you know, it's really good if your mom doesn't have anybody who's kind of showing a kind of a holding on to her, you know, and she really wants to be able to go, and she loves you, but, you know, she needs to go, and if you're kind of holding on to her and crying and stuff in where she's at, it's going to make it more difficult for her. And I would hope that my daughter would be, like, so super mature that she would be like, oh, I get it, you know, but probably not. And my fear is that me being saying that for myself would be very hurtful to her.
So I would write it down. Those are, that's your health directives.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to talk about that tomorrow afternoon. You're going to get your papers together, and I'll give you some examples of things, but I would put it in writing and keep letting her know verbally.
Okay.
Because that goes in, and they'll realize, and people step up at the end. I'm amazed. Like, my family's not Buddhist, but I've said to them so many times, but I've got papers, you know, but so many times I've said, like, I want to be cremated. That's not our belief system of how I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
They will cremate me, I have no doubt. They know what I want. I, you know, they don't even need to see a paper. They know those are my wishes. They know the other wishes. So they're going to find a Buddhist for me that's going to take care of some of those arrangements. But I have it written down, so then they know exactly who to call and who to do this and who, you know. And sometimes it's tricky because you move around the planet. So I'm not going to worry about that. I'm just going to trust that I would put it in writing and continue to verbalize it to her when it's appropriate, when
mm-hmm.
it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that she's aware, so that it doesn't have to hurt her. But then she can see, and you can even say to her, I just want you to read this over at some point when you feel. I'd like you to read it over in the next week or two so that you're really familiar with what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know it may be hard for you, but I would so appreciate, you know, and your son as well, right?
Yeah.
But so you just kind of a little bit, because I honestly, for years, worked on my mom. I wanted to know what she wanted. So she didn't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was really like, what if this happens? So her mother was, my grandmother was passing away, her mother. And my grandmother was very clear what she wanted when she was copacetic. So we just proceeded, and my mom was on the phone with me every day, and what, you know, and we knew. And it was easier for us because we knew what my grandmother wanted, so we just did that. And when my grandmother died, there was finally a nice little space. I was with my mom, and I finally said, you know, wasn't it great that we knew what to do for her, and we knew her wishes, and we just did that? And my mother totally got it. And then I said, that's just why I want to know what you want, so I can, you know, and then she told me. So I commend you for being the mom that wants to.
You have to think about how it's going, you know, as a mom, you think about how it's going to affect your children. I mean, first of all, getting over leaving the relationship on your part. But then, you know, you also think about how difficult it's going to be for them, and also trying not to take that on because it's not your place to take it on. But,
right.
But you know, it's a natural inclination.
And how old is she now?
She's 40.
She's 40.
Yeah. I know.
She's old enough.
Well, she's old enough, and I say, oh, she's old enough. She should be old enough to handle it. But I think of myself at 40, and, yeah, I wasn't as, yeah.
Right.
Still had a lot to go.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's 40 where when you're 40, I would think, not everybody, but when you're 40, you're much more aware of your mortality, and you're a little more aware of an aging parent as well if you're 40. So, you know, it's not like when you're 20.
Yeah.
20. Yeah, that's a little bit different. But when you're 40, you've been around people that have died and lost parents and this one, and so it's in there.
Yeah.
She may not be verbalizing it, but it's in there floating around. And she's probably thinking about, oh, what are we, you know, mom, and how she wanted, you know, what's the best way to take care of her, and what happens if this happens, and
being Buddhist and all.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, it's interesting. So that's why it's best to write it down. There's papers you can get them notarized. Some states will require that to make it legal. It's a legal document. Yeah, they can't go against those wishes. It's a legal document. If it turns up and people have their DNRs, do not resuscitate, but there's other wishes you can have on this legal document. It's legal, so they can't go against it and say, I don't want that Buddhist person in there. You designated you want this person in there. So it sometimes can be helpful, but better to discuss with them in advance so they know that, oh, my friend so-and-so will come, and she's going to be the one who calls all the lamas. So you just call her, and she'll take care of all that side, or that, you know, can be helpful, and it can alleviate all that stress even now. You don't have to worry then. I think people would appreciate, I would have appreciated that if my mom had just sorted that. I would have appreciated had my dad sorted the house and sorted what was going to happen to him in his old age. You know, he's living in a house by himself. And I came to live with him 3 years ago, but he's living in a house by himself that he's no longer maintaining, not interested in maintaining it, running out of money, and kind of not going to be able to take care of himself in the house much longer. But he didn't make any plans. So that's not helpful for your kids. You know, now your kids often are happy to help, and that's what we're doing, and it's been great, you know, but it's been stressful as well. And it's all been sorted, and it's going really well now, but there's been real stressors in the process, and it's kind of, and I have other friends where the parents moved out of the house, got a simple apartment, went into a retirement place, they took care, they got it all sorted. That was kind of nice, you know, that I didn't have to be the one to go through the attic and the basement and the workshop and the garage and the, you know. Fortunately, it's not a big house, but in the back, yeah, these two people, which. You can walk faster. Wait, were you the person who wanted to go to Laudo?
Never gonna make it.
You're gonna have to walk faster than that.
My mother and stepfather, due to the fact that they had two sets of grown children, had a trust, and not only that, they had their funeral arrangements already made. When my mother died, she had already picked out the casket.
My father has that. It's all done.
And
paid for everything.
It was such a blessing to our family because there was so much we dealt with in taking care of my mother when she was sick that when she actually passed, it was like the heavy lifting was done and with multiple siblings with very different personalities, that there was no arguing over what to do because Mom had written it down.
Yes. It's so great.
Yeah, and so we just knew you go, when this happens, we're going to such and such funeral home and they have a file with her name on it.
Yep.
Yep.
And the other thing is, if those of you that want to be buried in a casket with a funeral and everything, many of you are aware, caskets are very, very expensive. You can order online now. There's some kind of cheaper casket places, and, you know, they're very expensive. It's going to be the bulk of your funeral. And funerals, what I noticed was my grandmother died in 2003, and my mother passed away in 2010, 7 years later. And we used the same funeral director, same relative kind of services, and the amount it had increased in 7 years was astounding. So I got with my siblings and I talked to my dad and we're like, you know, it sounds kind of funny for some countries about prepaying the funeral, which we did. So hopefully he's doing well. You know, he's going to live many more years. It's already been several years and the price has already gone up. So you save a bundle of money if you do it earlier. I know my cousins, I have some cousins that live in Israel and they found this really bizarre. Because in Israel, it's the cheapest kind of thing. You know, you're buried in a shroud. They put you in the ground. There's none of that. It's just, and I think the state pays for something, and my cousins just thought it was absurd. And I'm like, you know, God bless America. This is what we do here. And it's very, very expensive. It's very expensive. So you can also opt, a couple of my friends cremated, you know, they just had some people have a coffin cremated. It's so interesting, my mind, because I was raised with funerals that you were buried. There's always a coffin there. The coffin that's wheeled in for the service, like you'd see in a church or a synagogue, anywhere. But then they put this thing that you just spent, you know, $10,000 on or $5,000, and then they put it in the ground. It's like taking $5,000 and putting it in the ground. Now when I see it, I'm just like, or they put it into a crematorium. So I know it looks nice, but I'm like a real cardboard box kind of girl. I've had a couple friends, just get me the cardboard box, they write your name on the side, that's you.
Cardboard boxes that actually look like...
Coffins. And they break down. They break down more quickly for ecological purposes. There are people using those like that. It's interesting. Back.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to frame this question. I have a...
Put it close to your mouth.
Trying to figure out how to frame this question. It's complicated. So I come from a culture where the death rituals, the funeral rituals are well-defined. And people have a very clear idea of what their roles and responsibilities are, including the person who has died. So I wonder, as a Buddhist, that family that's not Buddhist, what is my responsibility to them? Because at the time of death, I would be concerned, as I am now, when I think about my own death and how I'm preparing for it, what my obligation is to them, so they also have peace of mind, and they're not disturbed by the choices that I've made because I'm not having the ritual or the funeral they would expect and anticipate and they think is maybe, it's like, how can you deny us the rewards and the pleasure and the benefits and the blessings of giving you this kind of death?
So it's all individual. What you choose to do. And there's not one set thing about it. The main thing is discussing calmly and practically with your family in advance. So over years, they know your belief system and what you'd like. And that they're kind of ready for it. And then you legalize it and put it on paper and make sure that they're aware of that and they discuss. But in appropriate times, you don't want to foist anything on them, or they're in some grief mode, or they're upset, or they're... And a nice time, you find a time, and you might take one aside at a time. And say, I really want to talk to you about this. It's really important to me. If you're living near them or with them, this is kind of what I want. I just want to make sure you're comfortable with this, because I do think about you. And so that's what I would do. There's no set thing that it depends on everyone. I know a Buddhist nun that died in Australia, a close friend of mine. She died many years ago. Her family was Jewish, so she opted to be buried. She said for them she would be buried. She was in her early 30s when she died, so she was buried in her robes. Her mother was a Buddhist, but a lot of the other family were not, and that was what she decided to do, and she made them wait 3 days till the consciousness leaves the body. That's the Buddhist belief, because Jews bury right away. Generally, unless it's a Sabbath. And I think it evolved from being in a very hot Middle Eastern country. So it was a sanitation issue, because Jews and Muslims bury very, very quickly, and very similar, you know, from the same line they're basically from. And she, that was a compromise that she wanted to do, that she felt fine. But so it's really individual what you feel, you know. So let me just go on. I'll take some questions later, okay? Is I want to talk about what happens. I want to talk about reincarnation and what happens after we die. So, and then the body's really of no help, because the body's the reason you're dying. I mean, just not being supported. Okay, body has an illness, old age, things are not working. So, when we talk about reincarnation, we in Buddhism have a belief in the continuum of mind, the continuum of mind. So our minds are a stream of thoughts, feelings, ideas, memories, behavioral traits, and what they call moments of consciousness. And the mind exists with two characteristics only, only two characteristics, your mind. So if you've done the mind course and you're aware, don't say anything. But other people, what are the two characteristics you think that are your mind? This is what your mind is. What would you say is your mind? Anybody, but not from the courses if you know. Mind has two characteristics.
Clarity.
Clarity. So you're from the course, so don't answer if you know the answer. Sorry. Clarity is one of them. Okay. What's another aspect of your mind? Think about your mind.
Change.
You look around the room, change. For sure, that's part of it. That's part of the clarity in a way. Yeah. Impermanence, part of the change. That would be similar.
Awareness.
Awareness, thank you. Okay? So the mind is clear and knowing. Clear and knowing. That's your mind, by the way. So if anybody's new out there, they're like, what? Right? My mind is full of clutter. It has, your mind in its most subtle form has a clear light nature, like a spacious luminosity that is aware of things. That's your mind. That's it. So when we have emotional delusions arise and things, that's not the nature of your mind. Those come from previous imprints of those in your mind, but that's not the nature of your mind. So they've got this clear and knowing stream of consciousness. And what they say is it's made up of, part of it is moments of awareness, moments of consciousness, the same. I'm using awareness and consciousness and mind as synonymous, okay? And one thing I wanted to mention, this is just totally separate, and I'm not picking on you, the guy with the drink, I'm not picking on you, but I just wanted to mention, something for you to get into good habits, and Geshe-la is probably pretty relaxed, but I will make time for a break. You know, but normally during a teaching, you don't get up. You don't get up and get a drink. You don't get up and go to the bathroom unless it is urgent. There'll be time for breaks. What happens is very distracting for people around you. It's distracting for the teacher as well. So it's better you're in the session, then there's a break. Take a break. Get a cup of tea. Go to the bathroom. Just for you to get into better habits like that. It's really nice like that. So, the moments of mind, moments of consciousness, and what happens is, I'm not faulting anybody, usually we don't know. Nobody ever told you that. So I'm just mentioning, because I don't think Geshe-la will ever say like that. Tibetans never, they never will, you know, they don't like to say stuff like that. Americans, very direct culture, you know. So moments of consciousness, stream, moments of mind, and each moment of mind, they say, is preceded by a moment of mind that caused it. Every moment of mind has another moment before that caused it. Goes back and there's another moment before that that caused it. And another moment before that that caused it. Another moment before that that caused it. There's always, in Tibetan Buddhism, a preceding cause. A preceding cause. We're familiar with the word karma, which means action. Sanskrit word for action. Karma, simply the movement of mind, the movement of your mind. But thinking about anything that results, and you have to think about this. Please investigate what I'm saying, as I mentioned before. Don't just accept. Investigate. Think about deeply. Think deeply about what I'm saying. If something arises, could be a problem. Could be a happy moment in your mind. It could be that you got a new car. You got a new job. You have a great kid. You got the flu. You're having money problems. Does it just arise like that? You have to think of it. It comes from something else. Something that caused it. The car doesn't just show up in your driveway. Right? You don't just have a job. Somebody's like, here's a job. There's causes that work up. So each moment of mind has a moment before that precedes it. And so every moment right now, every present moment, is a result of the preceding moment. And so this moment is now the result of the preceding moment. And this moment, present moment, is causing the next moment that is a result of that. So you've got no beginning and no end, is what they say. The mind has no beginning and no end. It's somewhat inconceivable for us because we're linear thinkers, most of us. Monday, beginning of the week. December is the end of the year. This afternoon session started at 2. It ends at this. This is the beginning of this. This is the end of this. That's how we think. Practically, we have to engage like that. Practically, we have to know there's a time. Okay? So this beginning and endless mind is really a lot for us to think about. But so to think of, and what one thing I can, there's a meditation called the continuity of consciousness. It's a harder meditation to do. The continuity of consciousness, it's part of the Discovering Buddhism meditations on the mind, is you right now could trace from your seat to the back of the door where you walked in. Those of you that walked in the back door, or whichever door you walked in, and what you would trace is, and you could do this exercise right now, from the seat that you're in, I want you to think for just five minutes, how you got into the seat. And let's say the beginning of when you came here today. Some came in the morning, some came in the afternoon. So for instance, for you to get into the position to sit down, there are all these other activities that preempted that, right? Meaning turning your body around, the certain muscles moving, your brain dictating muscles to move in a certain way that activates neurological activity, that activates nerve endings, that the muscles moving the tissue, moving the bones, and you're in one seat, one position, but then you had to move to that position. So we would say, on another level, there's moments of consciousness that tell the brain how to move the body. Moments of consciousness that tell the brain to start maneuvering. And you're back at the door. Let's go all the way back to the door. You could see one moment's connected to the next, to the next, to the next. You're back at the door for a moment, walking through the doorway, and there's moments of consciousness. This is what Tibetan Buddhism would say, that operate visual consciousness. You look around the room now. So there's not really any muscles other than the eye muscles moving. And then that preempts, that starts and causes, okay, me to choose where I will sit. And that causes me to begin to direct the brain to move in a certain direction, to tell the muscles and the bones and to move in a certain direction over to that seat and then turn me around to sit me down. Take 5 minutes. I just want you to trace going back to the doorway and see if you can check on the connections of the moments of consciousness. Close your eyes and just try. Go back to the doorway. Notice the connectivity. So please relax. Slowly open your eyes. So if you go back with your mind and you want to find a first moment of mind, a first moment of mind, where would that be? A first moment of consciousness. What do you think about that?
There is none.
There is none, right? There wouldn't be one. There wouldn't be one because every moment would have a moment before that caused it, is what Tibetan Buddhism says. What people come to is the moment of conception. A lot of people go back there and say, I think that's where my mind started. Okay, so the moment of conception is when your body started, when your body started to develop. So a sperm and an egg came together, the egg gets fertilized. Okay, we're all aware of that process. And you can look at it under a microscope and see the cells replicating. So sperm and egg are physical in nature, and you can see them under a microscope. Okay? The mind is not physical. The mind is not physical. So this is hard for us to understand, that there's a mind somehow in this physical form. So, and the mind exists, and the body exists on three levels, a gross level, subtle level, and a most subtle level. Gross, subtle, and most subtle. The gross level of our body you're aware of. I don't mean gross, disgusting. I mean evident. You see a body here. Okay. The gross level of my mind is my various consciousness. I can see things, and I have different sense consciousnesses operating that hear a sound, and I see my mind operating, looking around the room and having thoughts and things like that. Okay. Then there's a more subtle experience of it. Subtle thoughts that kind of create another thought, and things that we're not that aware of. And the most subtle nature of the mind is this clear, light nature that we have no concept of. No concept, because we feel like our minds are full of gunk. Like that. So the body exists on this gross level that we see, but also basically operating by winds, a wind energy. Wind energy, okay, physical in nature, okay? We know this wind system in other disciplines, such as the Chinese system. It's called qi. Hindu Ayurvedic system, it's called prana. Tibetan system, it's called lung. Lung, L-O-O-N-G, sometimes it's spelled, lung, it means wind. So, for instance, this supports the body. Here's a gross wind. You can hear it, you see the lungs expand, like that. Subtle winds, okay? Subtle winds, they help me move my body and do all kinds of things with my body, but I'm not as aware of any wind energy. For instance, upward moving subtle winds allow me to speak, to cry, turn my head, blink my eyes, chew food like that. Downward voiding subtle winds allow me to eliminate waste from the body, walk, sit down, go to the bathroom, have an orgasm, like that. So when you're aging, naturally the subtle winds start dissolving. It's a natural life process. That's all. Okay. And if you believe in reincarnation, you've been through it countless times before. But it's a natural process. Some people are comfortable with that. A lot of people are not. So for instance, when upward moving subtle winds start degenerating, your hair turns gray or white. Your eyesight starts to fade. When downward voiding subtle winds start degenerating, your knees hurt. You're not as stable walking. You may have digestive problems. Erectile dysfunction. It's a standard subtle wind dissolving. That's all it is. Like that. So why does everybody make such a big deal about it? Right? But it's something to think about. These natural, it's a natural process. It's a natural process going on. So understanding this, can we be more at peace with it? Of realizing, you know, but you see all these anti-aging creams and all, if they really discovered something, you know, none of the rich people in the world would look like they're aging, but they all look like they're aging, no matter what kind of creams they use. Like that. People escape stuff. Hair dye. Different things. It's okay. There's nothing inherently good or bad about any of it. It's your own personal preference. But it's how calm can my mind remain like that. What kind of imprints can I continue to make in my mind will be positive that are going to keep me moving forward on this path like that? So it's something to think about. So it's an interesting exploration of if everything has a preceding cause, particularly the consciousness has preceding moments of mind that cause this next moment, and that means there's preceding, then it indicates a past life. When you come to conception, what happens with this most subtle wind that is the beginning of your body, physical in nature? Physical things cause other physical things. They don't cause non-physical things. Okay? And non-physical things, immaterial things like mind, cannot cause physical things. Okay? But I've got a most subtle wind operating, and that has a physical nature to it. And that allows the fertilization to take place. So again, this is extremely subtle, which is why molecular biology doesn't understand that there's some kind of other energy there, okay? It allows the fertilization to take place, okay? The most subtle mind has a unique way of attaching to the most subtle wind, but it's separate from it. It's distinct. One is physical, one is not physical, and it mounts that most subtle wind like a rider on a horse. Most subtle mind mounted on the most subtle wind. Okay, unique, distinct entities, but one, the most subtle mind, is informing how the most subtle wind is going to work. So the fertilization takes place, supported by the most subtle wind, and it is that mind that's attached there that starts getting into a less subtle nature, becomes subtle mind, but it's that mind that dictates how the body's going to form, how the life is going to be, what kind of things you're going to think about, if you're going to be happy, good body and mind, or deformed, or poor, or rich, or all based on the seeds that are imprinted in that consciousness. And that's the thing that carries on from life to life, the most subtle mind, that clear light nature with all the karmic imprints. That goes on from life to life to form to form. So then what happens is fetus, most subtle mind, most subtle wind mounted by the most subtle mind, and then subtly the form. As you need, this you can look at under a microscope, suddenly the fetus is there, and those most subtle, the most subtle winds develop into subtle winds, gets less subtle, and those subtle winds start branching out upward moving, downward voiding, and arm buds come, and then little eye things, and the head comes out, and the heart starts beating, and the legs form. All there. And the mind gets less subtle in that form as well, even though the subtle mind is there. Subtle wind is also there. And then different reactions start happening from the fetus in a more subtle way in the development. And then finally birth occurs. And then suddenly there's a gross wind as the baby comes out and cries. And then gross mind starts operating. You're hearing sounds and it's loud and you're feeling the blanket on you and all these things happen. And that's our life. And we go through that life for however long you go through. Then things start degenerating. The winds start degenerating. Again and again, we go through this cycle. The winds start degenerating. Let's say you have a death in old age. The winds degenerate, and finally, you're actually actively dying. The gross winds are going, and sometimes people are in bed and they can't get up anymore. I've watched my father, who's still in relatively good health, but you see this with a lot of older people. Because the subtle winds are going, right, they shuffle. The whole gravity of the body is down here. It's all lower now. It's all like you're worried about falling. There's a whole thing because there aren't as many winds working as well. Just a natural process, right? We're not as supple anymore like that. Body loses luster. Skin loses luster. Just normal. such a natural process. Why are we fighting it all the time, resisting it all the time? Okay? So slowly the subtle winds start degenerating, and then people actively start dying, and those winds start dissolving. From the top, they dissolve down to the heart center. From the bottom, they dissolve up to the heart center, to the point where some people can't move anymore. You might have heard people say this. And they describe very distinctly what you're experiencing. Okay. And so for the Tibetan system, the subtle, most subtle mind is located at the heart center. Okay. Not in the organ, the heart. That is physical. The mind is separate. There's a subtle energy system in your body. Okay. When you practice kind of tantra and go into more completion state things, you can study about the subtle energy network. But there are energy centers called chakras. Chakra simply means wheel. Wheel. You've got one at the heart. It's got a certain form, but it's got a center of it. Okay, again, not at the heart organ, but kind of in the center of your core. And they say there's a central channel that runs from the middle of your forehead up to the crown, where there's another energy center, crown chakra, curls around, goes down where there's a throat chakra, and it's a little bit more towards your spine. Goes all the way down, and its lower end comes a little bit lower than your navel. Central channel. It's the diameter of a drinking straw. It's slightly bluish on the outside in color, clear on the inside, but it's like a tube of translucent light. Okay, and the heart chakra is around this, and in the center of that, in the center of the central channel, is where there's an indestructible drop. This is according to the Tibetan system. And inside that destructible drop is where the most subtle wind resides. Mounted upon that, the most subtle mind. So when you actually die, the breathing ceases. We have all these internal visions that appear. Mind is still active. And they say it takes up to 3 days with a normal death of old age or cancer or something like that for the consciousness, for the mind, to leave that form. Okay, and what will finally happen when it's done its transition in there, different experiences happening on a more subtle level, then the indestructible drop will open, not anything you can see, okay, but the most subtle wind will leave the body, and on that level, the mind is going along with it. And then we say the consciousness leaves the body. I'll take questions a little later. The consciousness, hold that thought. The consciousness leaves the body. Where does it go? Goes into what's called an intermediate state. Intermediate state, a bardo. Bardo is Sanskrit for in-between. Goes into an in-between state. What is that like? Well, the mind's much more subtle. Meaning it's not like our gross mind here operating as a human and doing my stuff. And so basically you don't have a human body, a gross body anymore. A bardo being's body is much more subtle. A bardo being's body, an in-between state being, which is what you become, mind and wind there, okay, is much more subtle. And they say you can go through walls and stuff like that, travel different areas. However, what's going on for that bardo being, that intermediate state being, is it's totally dictated and catapulted by the imprints that are in the consciousness of that being, looking for its next rebirth. That's basically all it's doing. It's traversing through various scenes, scenarios, whatever, of what it's catapulted to do based on the imprints in that consciousness. Of what kind of scene are you going to come together with? What kind of contracts have you made, in a sense, contracts in quotes, that are going to dictate what kind of life I'm going to, what kind of rebirth I take? Okay. They have up to 7 weeks to take a rebirth, 49 days in this in-between state. You say, where is it written down? How do you know? These are teachings from the Buddha, from an omniscient being. You have up to 49 days. Every 7 days in that in-between bardo consciousness, you can have a mini-death, meaning a mini-transition, but it's not as dramatic as the one of getting us out of this form. And you're just basically looking for the next rebirth, of what rebirth you have a connection with. However, as an ordinary being, as a human, you do it uncontrollably. As a highly realized being, you're in control of where you take rebirth and how it goes. You can take rebirth at 7 days. If you have incredible virtue on your mind, at the death time, you may be transported very quickly into a very positive situation. Very negative, heavy negative imprints on your consciousness, you may be transported much more quickly into a much negative lower rebirth, like that. But basically at 49 days, absolutely, some situation will happen, and the mind at that moment, everything will reverse again, and basically there will be this subtle wind that will suddenly be there in, let's say, human conception. There'll be, let's say, two people making love. Now, not all conception happens like that now because of in vitro fertilization, test tubes, things like that. But the natural thing is you would take rebirth, and they say that if it's going to be a male child, they will be, let me see if I get this right, they will be looking at the father and having jealousy with the father. If there's a male-female making love or having sexual intercourse, they'll be looking at the father, having more attraction to the mother, and being jealous of the father causes them to come in as a male in that form. And the same reverse. If it's going to be a female offspring, they'll be having jealousy with the female, and attraction to the male causes you to take a female rebirth. Somewhat like that. And then suddenly the subtle wind is there, conditions come together as fertilization, and immediately the mind goes there, suddenly with the right connection with that, those kind of parents, that kind of situation, and then it starts all over again. And then the most subtle wind gets less subtle, fetus develops, mind dictating what's happening. And we do it over and over and over again. Isn't it exhausting? I mean, I get tired thinking about it sometimes. And when you go into the intermediate scope of the Lam Rim that deals with suffering, it examines suffering, right? And this is the first teaching the Buddha gave. There is suffering. So Buddhism examines suffering. Now, we don't dwell on it, overly dwell on it, but a lot of people say, and when I was running the center in California, we had a center next door to us. It was like a rich center, and they would have weekend programs. And this was in the 90s. This is a while ago. Weekend programs for $1,200 to $1,400 for 2 or 3 days. That's a lot of money. Now, you'd stay there and you'd get food. But we had a center next door that you'd stay there and get food, and we charged $75 for our courses. Right? It was a little different. And they had tons of people going to that center. And we would be like, you know, desperate, you know, if we could get 10 or 20 people. They'd have, like, it would be a traffic jam on Friday nights trying to get into their center. We're always like, yeah, you know. And then one of my friends came and said, well, yeah, I mean, they're teaching about, like, love and freedom, and we're talking about death and suffering. Where would you go? You know, you can have death and suffering for $75, love and freedom for $1,400. Okay, so... But the thing is, it's very significant to talk about suffering. There is suffering. So some of the sufferings are taking rebirth over and over and over again. They talk about how many piles and giant mountains of bones you've already created from past rebirths. So it's to generate you, to again motivate you to practice, to think, this is exhausting. You know, and right here in this one little life we have, right? I don't know all of your stories, but you've had, this is your life, right? It's just one roller coaster ride after another. Now, I don't mind roller coaster rides at amusement parks, but I don't really want it in my life. Life is dramatic enough. I don't need more drama at this point. And I'm really tired of the ups and downs. Really tired of the ups and downs. I'd really like to have a little bit more stable basis. Doesn't mean I don't enjoy. I enjoy more from a stable basis. I'm not so whipped by the, you know, this sucks. Oh, everything's great now. And, you know, and everything's great, you're not thinking about anybody else other than how great it is for you. But then it's down, and then, oh, woe is me. Me, me, me. Right? And then up again, and down. I find it exhausting. Something to think about. But that's what Tibetan Buddhism says, is this process of how we get out of one life through an in-between state, a bardo, and how we get into another form. So continue, if you can, please, to do practice that putting positive imprints in the mind that are going to continue moving you along where you can get enlightened and get out of that cycle. So when you're enlightened, your body will die. You won't suffer from it anymore. And you get to choose how, where, when, whatever you want to take a rebirth. And you're doing it simply to benefit all living beings. And you're happy all the time. You're blissful all the time. Let me see what else I wanted to say about this. So, you had a question, please. And then we'll take a short break.
So
wait, so this goes till 4?
Yeah.
4. So sorry, we're not taking a break. We have very short, sorry, we have very little time. I didn't realize, I'm sorry. Do we need a break? 5 minutes, people, are people okay? Okay, well then we'll take, yes, you could go. Yes, of course. If you have to go, go. I didn't mean it, but I just meant in general, you know, good to have nice discipline. Please.
So, I come from a Catholic background, and forgive me if I'm, like, getting this all wrong, but it sounds like the soul is what you're talking about, and it's leaving the body, and that place you go to is purgatory. Am I understanding that right?
So, first of all, we're very specific with our terminology.
Right.
So, what do you mean by soul?
So, that force that you talked about that opens up, that's in between your center chakra, that's what leaves your body. That's like, for lack of a better term, it's your soul. That's an appropriate way to think of it, right?
Okay. So is your soul, the idea you have a soul, is it unchanging?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't have that concept in Buddhism.
Okay.
Our mind is always changing. So that's a distinction, because in Christian soul, Catholic soul is often this eternal, and we have to be very careful about the terminology, eternal, unchanging entity. And eternal for us often means it goes on countlessly. We have that concept. The mind goes on with no end. But the eternal, you don't want to have it flip over into it's unchanging. And Buddhism uses terms instead of permanent and impermanent, they use more specifically changing and unchanging. But the mind, the most subtle mind, is always changing in nature. Even its clear light, nature is always changing. So we don't have this eternal, unchanging phenomenon that goes on. If you believe that the soul would be this changing thing that goes on from life to life, yeah, I would say it's similar to that.
Okay.
Purgatory is a place you go for all time and you stay there and it doesn't move and you can't do anything about it.
From my understanding...
With my understanding of purgatory, but I could be wrong.
Well, like, my understanding was, I don't know if anyone could correct me, but, like, that's, like, where you go... Like, it's neither heaven nor hell, and depending on, like, what you've done in your past life, you have to spend, like, a certain amount of time there.
Okay.
So...
And then you go to heaven. And then you go to heaven.
Okay, so purgatory is like a waiting room. Waiting
yeah.
room?
Yeah.
Okay. I would... Not pleasant. Okay.
I thought it was just, like, neither heaven nor hell.
A purification place. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like everybody's got a different idea about purgatory here. Okay. We're learning about purgatory. Okay. So I understood it as a waiting room, in a sense, waiting to determine, but I wasn't sure what you were doing in purgatory. Is it a positive waiting? Is it unpleasant?
Purging.
Purging. Okay. So you're purging so you can get to heaven. From purgatory, you don't go to hell.
No, that's correct.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay. Some people have a different idea about
that. I thought it... Oh.
Wait to get to heaven. Purgatory is like a limbo. Is purgatory limbo?
Limbo
something else.
I think there's no such thing as limbo now. I think they did away with limbo.
They did away with limbo.
I don't know. I don't know.
They did. But wait, so they did away with limbo. So what happens to all the people who went to limbo? Where are they now? Okay. But I'm not making fun of really... No, it's interesting to be specific about your terms, and it's very good to go back and learn about your religion, to understand, because I've gone back and studied... You know, it's fascinating, the different religions. But my understanding, if it's a waiting room type of place to purify, you're not necessarily purifying in the bardo. You're kind of uncontrollably going through experiences from the seeds in that subtle, most subtle mind that are dictating what will happen. In a sense, it is a kind of waiting room, but you're not really waiting there. You're really active doing stuff, but in a very subtle body like that, propelled, looking for this other rebirth like that. And it's not necessary that you go to heaven from the bardo. Depends on the seeds and the consciousness if they're very positive. We have types of heavens called pure realms or pure lands. There are different types of them based on what practice, deity practice you do. And they are heavens where you have every perfect condition to practice Dharma, and you, most of the people in some of these pure lands get enlightened more quickly. Like that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right back there.
Just a quick question on the Buddhist perspective. Takes 3 days for your consciousness to leave your body. What happens if you are cremated before the 3 days is up?
Okay. It takes up to 3 days, okay?
You don't know when that takes
place.
Right.
You don't. Well, you can know. So what happens, some people, in an accident and a heart attack, you may leave your body more quickly. Consciousness may go more quickly. What happens is there's a sign, a physical sign of the consciousness leaving because of the subtle wind, and it could be some fluid from the nose, like a clear liquid or a white liquid from the nose, maybe half a cup of liquid, could come out from any orifice in the body. The upper orifices are supposed to be better rebirths. The lower orifice, not good rebirths. If the liquid comes from the anus, it can indicate a hell realm. Hell rebirth that you're directed to. Comes from the sexual organ, it could indicate a preta realm. If it comes from the mouth, I think it is an animal realm. I think that the eyes are human realm, maybe eyes and ears, I'm not sure about the nose. The crown chakra, if you get a liquid from there, could indicate a god rebirth, that you be headed for that direction.
But my question is, so if you don't see any of that,
if you don't see that,
and they're cremated like on the third day, what happens?
The consciousness will leave anyway. Consciousness will leave in some way. It's just that sometimes things can disrupt, and you'd like it to try to just naturally get on its way in the least interruptive way. For instance, organ donation, which is a personal decision. Buddhists don't have a thing of this is good or this is bad. If you have a great motivation that you want to donate your organs, because there's no question many people can survive and live from your organs if you die, and it's an option, fantastic motivation, some fantastic thing to do if it's your choice. However, for great meditators, because they have to harvest the organs right away, they don't want anything to disrupt the meditation with the subtle mind, and those kind of things can suddenly, the consciousness will leave and you're in the middle of a, you know, high-level meditation, trying to actualize the clear light. What you're doing is you're trying to recognize the clear light mind, the mind in its most subtle experience. You want to recognize that clear light experience, which you can do now in meditations, okay? And the reason we want to recognize it is you can do emptiness meditation there that will actualize higher states of realization. So if that gets interrupted because, there, you know, it can jam up your meditation a little bit. But it's a personal decision about organ donation.
I think I heard something maybe from Geshe-la. I don't want to put words in his mouth. To think of the bardo, it's best to think of it as a dream. Is there any is there anything you can say about that?
Yeah, sometimes I think that subtle, not that I would know firsthand, the subtle bardo body, it's a more subtle body. So I think it's, in a sense, they say, sometimes say it's like a dream body. And you know in dreams how it's very real to you? And then you wake up and you're like, oh, I think it could be something like that, is the way I've heard it described. Yeah. So sometimes it's helpful that people can train in lucid dreaming, but just in general life, to not make such a drama over things and to notice some clarity of your mind and notice, or just notice if it's not clear, that how you're interpreting things and what you're layering onto things and what you're projecting onto things. And so that what happens is when you're actually dying, I would imagine, and what I've heard from people is if they're having a lot of visions appearing, and some of them could be scary, and that's what we're afraid of, right? But if it's scary and you see everything as a manifestation of the guru, there's no problem. Like, it's just us reminding ourselves. So, for instance, I see somebody at work. I'm just saying, you're at your work. And is there anybody, have anybody at work they don't like? A little challenging, right? Of course. Somebody in your life, a little challenging, a neighbor, a family member. And so when you see them, there's this, the body tightens up, pressure here, I want to go away from them, I don't like, you know, you're you feel all the tension around you, you know. So what if we suddenly just relaxed and said, this is a manifestation of my mind. This is a manifestation of a previous cause in my consciousness that's allowing me to see this right now, to experience this right now. And how wonderful that this being can show me my mind. They're actually quite a treasure. And I mean, there's different ways to spin it so that you get used to whatever appears, good or bad, negative, scary, horrible, fantastic. I'm present with my mind, just remembering the Dharma. Take refuge. Like that. That's your protection. Meditate on emptiness. That's the best protection. It's the best protection. As far as death practices, meditating on emptiness. So let me just wait. Did you have a follow-up behind from what, or both, either of you? If you've got...
I thought you said meditate, see it as a manifestation of your guru.
I
missed that part.
Meaning perfection. Meaning everything comes from Dharmakaya, truth, body of the Buddha, the wisdom that pervades everything from which everything comes. That's the absolute guru. So kind of realize, well, this is scary. Whoa, what is appearing right now? Oh, that's right. It's just this aspect of the subtle mind. I've got imprints in my mind. They're just showing this to me. There's nothing to be afraid of. Everything's fine the way it is. Okay, but that takes work in life. That takes work in life. And let me just, should I start this tomorrow or describe, we don't really have enough time, so we'll continue tomorrow on this. But I do want to leave you with one thing today before we take another question. Tomorrow I will talk about, this was from the Buddha, Rinpoche was quoting once, and it's not sure what will come first. I mentioned tomorrow or the next life, right? Never know, like that. I wanted to mention tomorrow I'm going to start with the death visions. So after the consciousness leaves the body, and even before that time, there can be, when the breathing actually stops, there's a whole internal mechanism of things that are appearing to the mind. The consciousness is still residing in the body, and there's these visions. These visions are more subtle. They get more and more subtle. Okay? In highest yoga tantra practice, you do these visions. You meditate on them every day. I have do them several times a day. His Holiness, I think, has said he does them 6 or 8 times a day because they come in certain practices. Okay? And the reason we do them every day is to familiarize your mind with these visions that will appear at the death time. So you want to recognize these visions. Why? Because they end in the clear light. And you want to recognize that clear light to do the meditation. For most people, it goes by like that. And you missed it. It's the mind in its most subtle form, which is a unique opportunity for you to do much deeper penetrative emptiness meditation. You know, there's an opportunity. And so for great meditators, they look forward to that opportunity. You're not hastening your death or committing suicide. That's really negative. But I'm just saying if you're dying anyway, you want to try to recognize that most subtle mind. Like that and do those meditations to actualize more highly realized states. So this is something we can look forward to. However, if you do these meditations every day, hopefully there's some familiarity in your mind. But these meditations happen. These visions happen for you right now. Every time you fall asleep, they happen. Every time you have a major sneeze or yawn, they happen. Every time you have sexual orgasm, they happen. Do you recognize them now? You do. Great. Okay. So mainly what happens is, and I'll just give you a quick pass and then we're going to review tomorrow. I want you to think about this tonight. The first vision, and I'll explain more detail tomorrow, is as the earth element is, and your elements are dissolving that make up this body. Okay? There's earth, water, fire, air. And that's what makes up your body. The earth element is this. It supports your body. I got my bones. I got my flesh. That starts dissolving. And people will say to me, even when they're still conscious, if they can't, and you'll see people, they can't lift their head anymore. They're in bed. And they feel like they're being crushed under the earth. Earth element dissolving. That's all that's happening. Relax. Okay, instead of getting scared, it's like, oh, right, this is a natural process, the earth element dissolving. There's an internal experience, which is a mirage-like vision. And that's your mind. It's your entire experience, mirage-like vision. We're going to do this meditation tomorrow. A mirage-like vision, like water. Like if you look out on a hot asphalt, you see the, it's like that, that's your whole experience. That's your mind. Not separate from your mind, that's your mind. Water element starts dissolving. Okay? Fluids are drying up in the body. Right? They'll talk about various sense consciousness are stopping, right? And what appears to your consciousness is a smoke-filled room. A smoke-filled room. Like you're in a room of gray, bluish-gray smoke. That's your entire experience. The fire element dissolves. So digestion ceases. Heat starts to go from the body. That's fire, right? And then you have sparks like vision, like you have a campfire, you put a blanket over it and the sparks in the night sky, like fireflies at night. Fireflies at night. That's your whole experience, okay? And then the air element dissolves. This is often when the respiration has ceased. Could be the last respiration, last exhalation. And there is a, the internal vision is a glow, like around a flickering flame about to go out. The radiance around that is your mind. That's what your mind is, okay? Merge with that experience. Then you get into the more subtle consciousnesses. So there is, and this is all different things happening in the body. Some winds coming up with a certain color, some winds coming down, all merging in the heart center, in the indestructible drop, in the subtle energy system, center of the heart chakra, like that in the core. And there'll be first a white appearance, like a big harvest moon over a field. That's your whole experience, that milky moon, kind of like that. The next vision will be a red increase, like a brilliant magenta-orange sunset. And then there's a black near attainment. When everything merges into the heart, black near attainment, because you've nearly gotten to the clear light, okay? And it's like a dead faint. So some people doing the meditation effectively really merge with it. Occasionally somebody falls over because it's like a faint. You know, as black can be. So the experience. And then the clear light dawns. So the clear light, I can't really describe like a most luminous, pure radiance you can imagine is your entire experience. Try to stay there as long as possible, meditating on emptiness. So as soon as a notion, a strong notion of the eye arises, you're analyzing. How does that eye exist? It feels like there's something strong, concrete, independent there. How does it exist? Can I find it somewhere? Slowly, you know, you're not finding it, stay with the absence then. Stay with the not finding. As long as you can. So some great meditators, highly realized beings, maybe in that meditative state, I don't know, 1, 2, 3 weeks, body could be upright, body dead, we would say, not decaying. But consciousness still there, not decaying, doing these meditations. And then sometimes, and I know one time in maybe at Kopan, it was hot, and Rinpoche asked Geshe Lama Khonshog, who had passed away, was in this meditative state. The breathing had stopped. Sometimes his eyes move. Now, you could say sometimes with, you know, little muscle spasms, they move. Somebody's head might turn. That's clinically, we've all heard about that as well. But I think he asked Geshe-la to quicken, to finish his meditation. So, you know, because the body, you know, usually the body will not decompose if the consciousness is there. I remember being with Rinpoche's mother when she passed away in India. Many of us were there, and hot India, and we all came to see her for 3 days. The body didn't smell or anything until the consciousness left, like that. So this is, again, according to Tibetan tradition. So those visions, mirage-like image, smoky room, firefly spark-like image, a glow around a flickering candle, a white appearance like a milky moon, a red brilliant sunset, a black near attainment, luminous, radiant, pure, clear light. Are you experiencing any of those now when you fall asleep? When you have sexual orgasm? When you sneeze? When, you know, we need to get ourselves ready. You want to recognize the clear light. So it's tricky. We have a ways to go. We have a ways to go. But you can slowly start. What's that? Fainting could be something like that. It could be related to that. I mean, sometimes it's some other physiological reason, but there could be something of a subtle consciousness is, yep, something like that. So it's not trying to make yourself faint. This is not a forced thing. This is, you visualize over and over and over, like several times a day. You slowly do the meditations when you can to soak your mind in. You're getting used to those visions. So when you're dying, if some of them appear, you're going to recognize it. Recognize like that. Everybody okay? Question.
I'm not sure my understanding is correct or not. Yeah. So you mentioned when the ego left the body, actually it's not.
The mind?
Yeah.
The mind. I didn't say ego.
Okay.
I'm being very specific. Yeah. There's.
So it's the most subtle mind together with the most subtle wind.
Yes.
They left the human body together, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, not only the most
yes.
subtle.
So they ride together.
Yeah.
Like a rider on a horse, but they're separate, distinct entities. One is physical,
okay.
One is not physical.
Okay. The other is, you mentioned, for example, sometimes when the most subtle mind left, for example, from the crown chakra, so it has some liquid over here?
Yes, if you get a fluid from the, somebody
yeah.
dies and there's a fluid from the crown.
So actually, this is a sign. It means the most subtle mind leaves from
be,
here.
It could be a sign. It won't be the mind because the mind's not physical, so you won't be able
yeah.
to see the mind leaving.
Yeah.
It could be a sign of the most subtle wind leaving the body. And the consciousness would be mounted on that, but not physical where you could see it. So it could be a sign of the consciousness leaving the body.
So did I, because you also mentioned, for example, the mind down to the heart chakra, and also the other mind, or is the window come up from the bottom to the heart?
So which mind?
That's what I tried to...
Right. Yeah. So all I was mentioning is there's subtle winds
yeah.
in the body, and when the downward voiding winds that help me walk and all these things, it'll eventually start dissolving up into the heart center.
Yeah.
You know, and there's kind of colors associated where you're going to get red energy kind of coming up from the heart center and then white energy from here, white drops coming down.
Okay.
Of the upward voiding, upward moving winds, subtle winds, coming down, everything meeting here. There's like a little white and red thing like this, and they merge together.
So both of them is a wind, subtle wind.
Mm-hmm.
Subtle wind.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But then the most subtle mind is mounted on that in this unique way that it can do that, which I can't say how it does that. I don't understand that process, but
stay there or
they stay there for a while as you're actualizing. Mentally, visions arising for you. There are visions that happen with those stages, and then eventually the vision ceases, the clear light mind ceases, and then that indestructible drop opens, and off that most subtle wind will go with the most subtle mind mounted into this in-between intermediate state. Bardo.
Thanks, Dan.
Yes.
Just the black near. Can you talk about the black one?
Black near attainment?
Yeah.
Is near attainment means you're close to the clear light. You've nearly gotten to the clear light, nearly attained the clear light, and it's like a dead faint, like when you faint, like black as black can be, and that's your mind. So when you're meditating on it, you try to visualize that as much as you can, as long as you slowly. Is that okay?
I used to faint a lot at the period, and I would just, it would be black.
Yeah, I mean, fainting's like that, yeah.
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 I don't faint now.
Right. I mean, that's just one thing, but if you're not catching the other visions, it's insignificant, you're just fainting. And a lot of people faint, so. But it's more we're trying, the main thing is to try to get familiar with these visions so that I'm familiar, so when I'm dying, you know, I sometimes feel a little bit like,
buckle my seatbelt, you know. I'm on the ride. Okay. But I want to have it so familiar that these visions will appear. If I'm not catching them now when I'm falling asleep, am I going to catch them when I'm dying? I don't know. There could be a very close friend of yours, very wonderful friend, who's reminding you of what to think about. That's what we do with people when they're dying, when they're actively dying, Buddhist friends. Sometimes we get a call from Rinpoche, you know, yell loudly in her ear about refuge. Remind him about emptiness or do this. It's very helpful, really. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that can help because you could be lost in your experience. You're dying and you're like, whoa. And somebody, suddenly you hear something, take refuge. Okay. Got it. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Like, I would like that on my amusement ride, rather than like some... So that's the main thing, is just to try to familiarize our mind with those visions that will turn up at the death time. This is just according to Tibetan Buddhist tradition, like that. Yes.
I have a question about Tibetan Buddhist philosophy. I come from a Hindu tradition and have a lot of similar ideas about the subtle body, subtle mind.
Uh-huh.
And but you say this most subtle mind is attached to this most subtle wind. So it goes from one life to another, and the subtle body goes from one life to the next. In Tibetan...
The subtle body doesn't, in a sense. There is this subtle wind, most subtle wind, but it shifts a bit in the bardo, in the intermediate state. And so our body, and I'll put it this way, there is a sense of an energy, but no, I just wanted to clarify, it's not like a gross body, because when this dies, this is done forever. Yeah, so I just wanted to clarify, yeah.
But so my question is, like this gentleman here says you have a soul, so it seems like to me, and I'm a novice Buddhist, that the ultimate goal for Buddhism, I have some confusion about, is it to merge with nirvana, or there's also a conception that you go on to be a bodhisattva and you continue to work for the benefit of humanity. So in an eternal individual kind of situation, you will still be some version of, some future perfected version of Amy will go on as the bodhisattva version perpetually, individually. It's a big question, a big topic.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's fine. I just want to clarify some things because what often happens is people mishear and then they go out and are, you know. So I'm just being very, so we don't have a soul. I didn't say we have a soul. He said there's a soul.
Right.
Catholicism. We don't have a concept of soul or Atman.
I'm talking about an eternal individual consciousness.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm just clarifying. So the only thing I was identifying with soul is mind. I wouldn't call it soul in Buddhism. We don't call it soul. Because a lot of times what's attributed to soul is this unchanging kind of entity. We don't have that. The mind's always changing. So we have a mind with no beginning or end in a gross, subtle, and most subtle experience that is not physical. So what we're trying to do on the Buddhist path, the Buddha gave 84,000 different discourses that because there were so many different beings appropriate. So nirvana is a type of enlightenment for the Theravadan tradition. Buddhism that branched out into Burma originally from the Buddha in India and then became in Thailand the Thai Forest tradition with some great masters like Ajahn Chah that the Vipassana movement in the States and all over the world has come from, like that. So their getting free of their suffering is their nirvana and that's kind of their enlightenment. Tibetan Buddhism, Mahayana tradition, universal vehicle or greater vehicle, takes it a little bit further. Nirvana is a step on the process, but with nirvana, which means liberation in Sanskrit, you are free permanently of all your mental afflictions and suffering, but you still have subtle obscurations to omniscience. So we would continue on a bodhisattva path. There's different grounds and levels, okay? And then you would continue to work on that mind on the bodhisattva to get rid of the subtle obscurations until you become fully enlightened, fully awakened, when you're omniscient. And then the reason you're doing it on the bodhisattva path is to benefit all living beings as an individual consciousness. There's a debate that is that individual consciousness part of a mass collective enlightened consciousness? That's debatable. I don't know. Some people say yes, some people say no. Does that clarify?
Yes, big topic.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so keep exploring. Keep exploring a bit like that. Good question. Thank you. So we are out of time. I'm going to stop there. And we have a puja at 4:30. It's a tsog day, so anyone that would like to join us for about an hour and a half. And what I'm going to do is we're going to start with this meditation. Tomorrow morning there's a different class. We're going to do something a little bit different, but I may talk a little bit, see if I bring in the death thing, and then we start again in the afternoon, I think 2 o'clock. Is that right for the lunch break?
12 to 1:30. So it starts at
1:30. 1:30, okay. So we've got a class from 10 to noon. 10:30 to noon. And then it'll be an hour and a half lunch, so 1:30 to 4. 1:30 to 4, that'll be perfect. Yes, so we'll start with the death absorptions. We're going to talk about getting into the more practical stuff that we do as well. Thank you very much. So I'd like to dedicate the merit. I want to thank you so much for your attention and time and coming. And one thing I wanted to mention, just to take a commercial break for a second before we dedicate. I mentioned the Laudo Pilgrimage. This is a little flyer. There's some more out there. It also accesses my website where there's a detailed itinerary of this pilgrimage I'm leading in October to go to this sacred mountain, a cave where Rinpoche supposedly got enlightened in his last life. It's a very, very special place in the Everest region, Mount Everest region in Nepal. And the itinerary is there, how you sign up if you're interested. It's also to raise money for Laudo. A little bit of the offerings will go to Laudo. My website, I have some cards if you'd like as well, have more access to a YouTube channel with a lot of different teachings, and there's an audio and video tab as well, and you can get some teachings that are all categorized by topic if that's helpful for you. But there's a lot of other great teachers online like that. So I wanted to just mention, and it's so nice, this center has some of these flyers out there, and I brought some with me if you'd like one. The our monks and nuns of our organization have a separate organization called the IMI, the International Mahayana Institute. So monks and nuns in the West struggle. And it's really been a very difficult thing because we don't have adequate monasteries and nunneries. And of the FPMT, there's very few. And there's nothing in North America. So we are often on our own. And there's people like me that go from center to teach. I have a base right now at my father's house where I have to pay the utilities and it's quite expensive. And or you're at a center that has a residential option, so you do a job and they give you a room and they give you food and they give you a stipend. When you don't want to do the job anymore or, you know, things, they need your housing for somebody else. So there's really no place we can go and just stay there and study and do what we're supposed to do and be with other nuns. And it's tricky. So they've asked me to raise some money for them. So this is a way. There's a website on here you can go to if you ever want to make a donation, and I really, really appreciate it. It's also available to make offerings to monks and nuns as well. People don't know that you can do that, and it's enormously helpful, and people don't know that we're not supported by the FPMT. So it's just kind of raising awareness that if you want to have Sangha, it's not that the FPMT doesn't want to, just there's many projects and living in the West is expensive and they support a lot of Sangha in some ways, some Western Sangha, and they support a lot overseas at the monasteries in India and Nepal where it's much cheaper and things, but here we are, right? So if you do want this to take off in the West for there to be Sangha and to understand the benefits of that, how they can continue the Dharma through their study and practice and teaching and have communities that support lay people as well, then we have to start supporting that. So I just wanted to make that announcement. Thank you so much, and feel free to come up if you want any of these. But I'd like to dedicate the merit and turn to our gold prayer book. And I would like to read and send this out to the universe. If I can find it. Page 246 from Master Shantideva. This is a great Buddhist saint, and this is one of His Holiness's favorite dedication prayers. It's a beautiful prayer. So in taking all of our positive energy that we've created here, and I want to thank you so much for coming, may we learn to really invest in our practice so that we have something very substantial there for our death time, so we can have peaceful deaths. And can we use our lives right now in a meaningful way so that we can move along this path to full awakening, becoming Buddhas, so we can benefit all living beings. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. The poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, those bound be freed. May the powerless find power. People think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Page 244, the long life prayers for His Holiness and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Tenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. So also for Chris Kettner, who passed away this morning, I'd also like to dedicate to Lance Haddix, who's the father of Chase Haddix, who's part of your community, who recently, he died in January. And for a good friend of mine, Ed Weiss, who passed away a couple of weeks ago, and Joey Baskin, who was a 15-year-old suicide related to my family a few weeks ago. So if we can just, all these beings all over the planet who need healing, and may they immediately be freed of their suffering and know ultimate happiness. Thank you very much, and hope to see you tomorrow.